You are listening to the Parkside Baptist Church podcast for Sunday morning, January 20th. Dr. Jeffrey Smell preaches a message entitled, Keep Your Fork.
I want to call your attention back into Hebrews chapter 11, those two verses I read before we prayed. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. And verse 16, but now they desire a better country, that is a heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. I want to start the message this morning with a statement of fact. And I want you to listen to me carefully. This is not the most important thing I'm going to say, but it'll launch out into, hopefully, much more important things. And I have, for all of my 53 years of life, I have had a fixation, if you will, on food. I hate to confess my sins like this, but church is the place to get right with God. And I have always, always enjoyed food. Some guys hate to go to the grocery store. I like going to the grocery store. I don't mind going. And especially if I got money, I like to go. If I have any glaring weaknesses in my life, this could be it. I understand the principle that you are to eat to live and not live to eat, but I struggle with this principle. It started when I was a teenager. When I was a teenager at about 14, 15 years of age, I could go to the local McDonald's, and I kid you not, I could eat two Big Macs, two large fries, and two large vanilla shakes, one setting. Now, I'd be lucky if I could get a vanilla shake down at one setting, but that's the way I could eat as a teenager. I had never had an issue about worrying about food and what it did to you and weight and things of that nature. Never had a problem with it. When I was a young teenager, I had a friend that spent the night from our church, and this was in the days when Bonanza was a hit TV show, so you know how long ago this was. But it was in the summertime, and she spent the night, and the next morning we got up, and it was breakfast time, and so we came into the kitchen there in our house there, and Mom had just bought four brand new boxes of cereal. And so I said to my friend Gary, let's go ahead and have a contest of cereal eating. And he said, I'm up for it. And so I said, here's what we're going to do. Let's go ahead and see how many boxes of these cereal we can eat in the time we have and who can eat the most. And we're going to do it as fast as we can. Well, one of us, I don't remember one or the other, we got the idea of humming the theme to Bonanza while we were eating the cereal. And so there we go. I mean, we poured our bowls, go. And dun 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 dun. And we're doing it. And shoving it in as fast as we could. Milk falling all over and things falling all over. And we're laughing and eating as fast as we can. Of course, my mom's nowhere around or she would have killed me. You won't believe this, but we downed all four of those brand new boxes of cereal. And I think those were trademarks of my youth and great days that I could not do today. When I turned 40 years of age, something happened. I had to start worrying about my weight. I'm sure that if I had not ever been concerned about my weight, I would be, as they say, as large as a house by now. But I honestly, believe it or not, I honestly do concern myself with my weight. And I, several times a week, go out into the neighborhood and run and walk and run and walk and run and walk and sometimes walk and walk and walk and run and walk and walk and walk. But I do to try and stay on top of this because something happened when I turned 40 and my metabolism left me. And no longer could I process the food as fast as I used to as a teenager. I remember so many different times I've gone to conferences and seen guys I went to Bible college with and how they've changed over the years. And, oh, they keep the same doctrine and the same belief and the same practice, but they don't look the same they used to look like. And that's one of the things about being a Baptist. You can't be a Baptist if you don't have food involved in it. It's always about food. And so, with eating as one of my favorite sports and pastimes, I've enjoyed the ministry and serving the Lord. And not only am I married to a great cook, but I've had the privilege of eating a lot of good food. A lot of ladies in churches are great cooks, and they put their best recipes together for the times that we eat and the times they would invite us over while I've been in the ministry. You know, when you come over to somebody's house, they host you and they put a nice dinner out and they're going to put their best stuff on the table and not a plastic fork like I gave you, but their nice silverware and their nice china and put the best things out there. Invariably, here's how it goes. You eat your salad and your first course and you drink your drink and you finish all of these things, and then the hostess comes by and she starts clearing away the plates, and as she does so, she says something to this effect: keep your fork. And you know what it means. Nobody had to teach me what it means. I didn't have to go to school to learn that. When they pulled that plate away after I finished that first course and salad and appetizer and everything, when they pulled that away and she said, keep your fork, I knew exactly what that meant. That meant that the best was yet to come. Dessert was coming. The best was yet to come. Now, my wife happens to love dessert. In fact, she loves it so much that when we go out to eat, many times she'll order a side salad, maybe a bowl of soup, and a piece of pecan pie, and the waiter or waitress will turn around and she'll say, now, wait a minute, I want the pecan pie first. She eats her desserts first. But that hostess, when she told us this, we knew then good things were about ready to happen. Keep your fork, and you get that fork off your plate. I happen to bring a fork from the kitchen today, and our kitchen, and this is one of the forks I really enjoy. And I thought I'd bring my favorite fork as opposed to one I don't care for. But we have small forks. Sophie has a small fork, and Bronte and Elena have a little bit bigger fork. But for us big adults, we got the big ones. And I brought that as a illustration to you and gave you one as an illustration to remember about this principle about keeping your fork. But you'd be pulling that away and maybe you'd lick your fork off like I and get the residue off of the last part of that good meal, and you'd set it right there, right close by, and wait for that dessert to come. Why? It was to be the best part of the meal. Now, I want you to listen to me carefully. For as a Christian who lives in the last of the last days, I believe Jesus is coming soon. We're not in the last days. We're in the last of the last days. We're in the tail end. But as a Christian that lives in the last days, you face a daily dose of discouragement for doing nothing more than simply living. Oh, when we serve the Lord, the discouragements can increase because we are in a battle. But the everyday grind of life has many discouragements involved with it. Think about this. We possess in this generation more money than any previous generation, more possessions than any previous generation, more entertainments than any previous generation, more time off and rest than any other previous generation, more mobility than any other previous generation, more education than any previous generation, and more wealth than any previous generation. But we also possess more discouragements than any other previous generation. And we face them with all that we possess, far more than our ancestors ever could dream or hope for. Why are we discouraged? Why are there more suicides than ever before? Why are more people depressed? Why are more people discouraged? Why is there more drugs to treat this? Why are there more psychologists and psychiatrists who at one day in American history, if you went to one, you would say it on the side, not be bold about it, but now we broadcast that we go to our psychiatrist on a regular basis? Why is there more gloom and doom? Why is there more negativity if we have more than others have had? Why do we have this? Why is it that we see that people who seem to have everything in life that you could ever want in life, why is it they end up taking their life before the prime of their life? Smith Reynolds was the heir apparent to the R.J. Reynolds tobacco wealth and industry. He was 22 years of age, and he had, at that time, he had been the youngest member of the United States to get a pilot's license. He had traveled around the world 6 times completely in every, because he had so much money, completely in every country and spent time in every country. He had all that anybody could ever want, even had his own personal butler who served him personally day and night. And one morning the butler came to wake him up for breakfast and there was no response. And he knocked harder and yelled for him, "Mr. Reynolds, Mr. Reynolds!" No response. And being fearful and worried, he got a couple of men and they broke into the door. And there on the bed, they saw the revolver with the silencer and the note. And Smith Reynolds had taken his life. And on the suicide note, he said, "I've done everything that there possibly is to do. What reason do I have to live any longer?" At age 22. When I pastored in Northern Ohio, there were three bus kids that were very faithful to come every week. And they were constantly wanting to get their mom to come to church. And they'd try and invite her and never could get her to come. And they'd beg her to come. And we'd go out and visit. And bus workers would visit. "Come on, kids want you to come." They were very faithful to come, but mom would never come. Then one Sunday morning, I'll never forget, one of the three children came to me. "Preacher," he said, "Mom came today." "Really? Great. That's wonderful." Well, not only did mom come that day, but she walked the aisle and at the altar trusted Christ as Savior. I baptized her in the baptistry, and I was thinking, this is great. They had been wanting that. They had been praying for it. We had visited and prayed for it, and now it's happened. The next day, Monday afternoon, I got a phone call from one of my assistant pastors. He said to me, "Preacher, did you hear the news?" I said, "What news?" He gave the name of the lady with the three kids who got saved and baptized the day before. He said, "She just jumped off the bridge and killed herself." See, in her mind, she was going to do everything she knew to do in a sense of getting ready to meet God, but she had no will to live. She had no desire to live, and she left three little children behind without a mom or a dad or anybody to care for them and be wards of the state. Why? In a time of so much success and prosperity and good things, why would she take her life? Well, the real problem is this. We've taken our fork and we've laid it down. We've forgotten what the fork represents. If you've trusted Jesus Christ as Savior, you're born again. And if you're born again, then God is your Father. The Spirit of God lives inside of you. And heaven is your resting place, your final home. The best is yet to come. And yet, how often do we get discouraged in life? How often do we get despondent? How often do we get to the place where we don't want to go on and we don't want to continue on and we feel like it's not going to work and they're going to make it? How often have maybe some of you ever thought about taking your own life? In Hebrews 11, we read the list of the people of faith that most would agree are probably the greatest Christians of the Bible. They had accomplished great things for the name of the Lord, and yet they did so and paid a price to do it. For we read in the same chapter in verse 32, the Bible says, "And what shall I more say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon, of Barak, of Samson, of Jephthah, of David also, and Samuel, and of the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others had a trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn asunder, they were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and in mountains and dens and in caves of the earth. And these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise. God, having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect." How could these people go through such extreme circumstance and trials? Keep in mind, they did it without a psychologist. They did it without drugs. They did it without self-help books. They did it without support groups. They did it without alcohol. How could they do such a thing as you just read? This is how they did it. This is how they did it. For in verses 13 through 16, it says that they knew the promises and embraced them. Verse number 13 says, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off and were persuaded of them and embraced them. They believed them. They held on to them. They knew something better was on the way, and it was just a matter of time before they would receive that better country. I tell you this morning, they kept their forks. And listen to me this morning, dear friend. You may have come here discouraged of heart. You may have come here feeling depressed of spirit. You may have come here despondent of life. The truth is, you don't feel that way because of the circumstances you face. The truth is, you don't feel that way because of the surroundings of your environment. The truth is, you don't feel that way because of the lack of what you feel you ought to have in life. But rather, you feel that way for one reason and one reason only. You don't have your fork in your hand anymore. You have taken the promises of God that have been given and preserved for this generation in His Word. And you have taken them and you've laid them down and have ignored them and turned from them. And so you're discouraged and despondent and fearful and worried and anxiety risen. And the reason is you don't have your fork anymore. You put your fork down. You forgot that as a child of God, a better country waits for you. You forgot that as a child of God, a better body waits for you. You forgot that as a child of God, a better life waits for you. And you put your fork down thinking the best is already here, and yet the best is yet to come. I say to you this morning, pick your fork back up again. Lick it off if you want to. Shine it up and make it shiny if you'd like. Move it from hand to hand, from side to side. But for whatever you do, don't you dare put your fork down. You keep that fork up because it's a constant reminder of God's promises that the best is yet to come. Used to be a beer commercial when I was a kid. I grew up in the TV generation, which is amazing because they didn't have cable. They had antennas. It's these things with little prongs like this. Didn't have internet. I grew up in the TV generation in the 70s. Used to be an old beer commercial on. Brother Palmore reminded me about it the other day. In a happy, well-lit bar, everybody slapping each other on the back, friends and neighbors, and having a good time. And I don't know the type of beer, it doesn't matter what it is. But the caption is, it doesn't get any better than this. That's what they believe. It doesn't get any better than this. And can I tell you that if they're not saved, they're right. That is the best they're ever going to get it. That is the best they're ever going to know it. That is the best they're ever going to experience. But it is not the best of life. For a child of God knows the promises of God. They know that something better has coming its way soon. For eye hath not seen, ear hath not heard, neither has entered in the heart of man the things which God has prepared for them that love Him. We can't even imagine how great heaven is. Oh, we know it's got walls of jasper, gates of pearl, streets of gold. We know there's no death, there's no sorrow, there's no sickness, there's no bills in heaven. We know that nothing that defileth shall enter in, but we only know the surface of what's really there. We really don't know all of the ins and outs. It is so magnificent and so above our understanding that God can't even give us anything to match it with on earth to tell us how great it is. So he says, eye has never seen how great heaven is. Ear has never heard how great it is. And neither has entered in the heart of man the things which God has done for them which love Him. I'm saying to you this morning, keep your fork. Something better is about ready to come. But how many people in a moment of discouragement or disappointment drop their forks and miss the best part? Then live inside that discouragement, their depression, their defeat. But as a preacher and a child of God and a Christian, I've sometimes had to face those things head on. I've had to face the discouragement, the depression, and the defeat. And sometimes you wonder if you're even going to live through it. You wonder if you have the physical body and strength to make it. But I tell you how you make it. You keep that fork. Our first child, which none of you have met, she died in 1991. Was born with Down syndrome. but had an irreparable heart disease. Instead of having the four chambers of the heart, her heart was without any chambers at all. And her right ventricle was so small that they could not repair it. And because she had Down syndrome, they would not give her a heart transplant. So we had to work around that. She was just a few months old when she had her first open heart surgery. With the 4 years of her life that God gave us, she had four open heart surgeries. The last surgery where they tried to divide her heart into two. She went through the surgery fine but could not recover. The direction of the blood flow, you know, heart's a muscle and it has to accept the blood flow. It could not accept it. It had never done this before. After 3 weeks in the ICU room, the Lord took her home. Somebody asked me one time, they said, how'd you make it through that? It's our only child. We didn't know we were going to have any others. We had no idea. How'd you make it through that? Well, I can only tell you, I'd like to say because I just am such a great Christian and I just stand on God's word and I prayed and fasted and I'd love to say that. I'm not that great of a Christian. I'd love to say that I had 100% faith in God and I knew that whatever was happening was going to be what was best. And I'd love to say that I come on the top side because I'm just such a great Christian. No, I just held on to a fork. I just believed that if God was going to take her life, something better was coming. I just believed that if God was going to take her from our presence, that he was going to take her to his presence. I just believed that that little girl that was born with trisomy 21, Down syndrome, was going to be in the arms of Jesus, no longer with trisomy 21, no longer with a heart disease, no longer with any kind of difficulties or disabilities, but now in a new body and set free from the bondage of a bad body. I believed it and held on to my fork. And my wife believed it and held on to her fork. That's how you lay your daughter on the surgeon's table to perform heart surgery, which is what I had to do. I held her in my arms and laid her on the table of her last surgery. That's how you stay by her side in the ICU, often with no sleep in hopes of recovery, watching the movement of every monitor and every beep. You were hanging on to everyone because you had your fork. That's why it's how you can say goodbye to her as the angels whisk her off to heaven. Because you have your fork. That's why you try to comfort your wife, who for the first time in 4 years has found herself as a wife without children. That's how you preach your funeral when your heart's breaking in two. That's how you go soul winning the next day when you'd much rather sit at home and cry. That's how you endure the next full year alone, childless and hurting with none to really comfort you. I can tell you the only way you can do it is to hold on to this fork. That's the only way. You've got to believe something better from the Lord is coming. I sat outside our church building the morning, that Wednesday morning in June of 1991 when I had to preach my daughter's funeral. I was there a full hour or so before anybody else showed up. There was a singing group that had come by and they had given me a tape of their music that they'd sung. And they had a song they sang, God shall make this trial a blessing. Never forget the chorus of it. God shall make this trial a blessing, though it sends me to my knees, though my tears flow like a river, yet in him I find sweet relief. There's no need to talk discouragement. There's no need to talk defeat. God will make this trial a blessing, and the whole wide world shall see. And I kept singing that over and over again. And I kept rewinding it to that just the chorus and singing again and singing again and singing again. And tears flowing. I'm trying to convince myself that that's true. Our Gems and Jewels ministry here is the 27th special needs ministry my wife and I have had a part of in America. It started with our daughter in 1990. I estimate on any given Sunday, 500 in America, 500 special needs children and adults are sitting in churches like this because of that one girl. If I throw the estimate into the next category, I would have to estimate that 2,000 people beyond the 500 of those special needs children and adults, but their family members, mothers, as in this congregation here, mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters, are sitting in a church like this morning. 2,000 Because of one child, God did make the trial a blessing. My wife wrote her story in book form, and it's gone, thousands of copies now have gone out, and I hardly can go to a conference where I don't find somebody come up to me I've never met before and they say, I read your wife's book, and it meant so much to me. I've pastored dozens of people who are proof of this truth. I've pastored the lady with a special needs son who her husband left her because he wasn't going to deal with the special needs of the child, but she raised him all on her own. She did it because she kept her fork. I pastored the man whose wife was one of the finest Christians our church had ever known. And was a great soul winner. At her funeral, I just read the converts' names and addresses of the people she had led to Christ over the years. But as she got up in years, her health had broken so bad that she could only make it to one church service. And she could not physically fix herself to come to church. So her husband, who is just a man from Kentucky with no real education, he learned how to do her hair. He learned how to do her makeup. He learned how to do her nails. He learned how to put her apparel on. And every Sunday morning, he would totally dress her so that she could come to church. I thought, greater love have no man seen than this. The man would do that for his wife because he loved her. He did so because he kept his fork. I pastored the lady who sat in church and for years struggled with calling God her father, even though she believed on Jesus, because she grew up with an abusive father that was so bad sexually, physically, and emotionally to her, she cringed every time she heard the word father. But she stayed in church because she kept her fork. I pastored the parents whose son was called of God to be a preacher and was at Hiles Anderson College preparing for ministry for about a year, but got around the wrong crowd and left that and backslid and left the will of God and ended up at somebody's house away from God, away from church, away from the things of heaven. And in a moment of foolishness, playing with a loaded gun, accidentally shot himself and killed himself in his 20s. I pastored that family. They never missed a service. They never missed a beat. So how do you do stuff like that? You keep your fork. That's how you do it. You keep your fork. I pastored a man with osteoporosis so bad that the doctor said he had the bones of an 80-year-old when he was just 31 years of age. And I'd call on the phone and talk to him, his wife, and I could hear him in the background screaming in pain, and nothing could ease the pain. And yet, at every available moment, there he was in church. How? Keep your fork. I pastored the lady with advanced MS who could not put herself in her wheelchair to come to church. She was an elegant lady, refined lady. I used to sit in my office and weep every Sunday morning. I watch her husband get her out, and I knew this was hard. He'd wrap his arms around her and jerk her up and lift her down and set her into that wheelchair, and I knew she was embarrassed at that, but she wasn't going to miss church. She wasn't going to keep from God's house just because she had multiple sclerosis. How do people do stuff like this? They keep their fork. Listen to me carefully. This could be the week when the doctor tells you it's cancer. This could be the week when your husband or your wife walks out on you. This could be the week when you receive the pink slip from work or the place you thought you were going to retire from, and they've retired you without the retirement. This could be the week that you have a heart attack. This could be the week that you have a car accident and you're paralyzed for life. This could be the week where someone in your family has a child born with special needs. This could be the week when your child turns away from God and goes into the world and breaks your heart. This could be the week that you face a surgery with little or no good results promised to you. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? Your money ain't going to help you. All the electronic trinkets of the world ain't going to help you then. All the friends you got can't help you. What are you going to do then when you face that? I'll tell you one last story and we'll be done. The second floor, Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital. When the elevators open up, you open up into the waiting area for the PICU. I've spent many, many hours, days, and weeks there. Hannah was 29 times admitted to Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital in Cleveland, Ohio, for at least one night up to 3 weeks' time on others. I knew that PICU like about anything except for almost as much as I knew my own home. I've been there so much. And we would come up there, and she would be there, and only two people could be in there at any one time in the PICU. And so family members, church members, so forth would come, and one of us would have to come out. We'd sit there in that waiting room area there. And across the waiting room area, about where I am here, where the magnets are, there was a set of doors. No numbers or anything on them, just doors that were closed. And every once in a while, because I sat there so long, I could see one door open up, and it was a janitor's closet. And I could see another door open up, and it was storage. There's one door directly across that opened up every day, several times a day. And no number, no name, nothing to it. But I knew what was going on in there. See, what would happen is first somebody from the hospital would usher a mom and dad into that room. They'd open that door. It was a narrow room. Probably the hallway of it was probably 4 foot, and it probably went about 6 or 7 feet and then opened up to maybe a 4 by 8 area. You got a love seat, a chair, and a table with a lamp there is all there was. It was very narrow, a couple pictures on the wall. Somebody from the hospital would take a mom and dad and put them in that room and say, just a moment, the doctor will meet you there. And then a few moments later, the doctor would go into that room, and they would be in there for 15, 20 minutes. It was always the same thing. The doctor would come out first, and on his way. 15, 20 minutes later, you'd see those parents come out, tears flowing, holding on to each other, like they couldn't even stand, like they're going to fall over. And they'd struggle to find family and respite. You sit there and watch that all day long, day after day. You start picking up what that room is. That was the room where the doctors would say there's nothing else can be done for your child. That was the room. Our cardiologist was Dr. Ben Shikar, a Jewish man who was getting close to retire. In fact, he wanted to retire after Hannah's surgery. And they were so positive. They believed that Hannah's last surgery was the end-all surgery, and she was going to do well and be strong and at least give her another 20 years of life, if not longer. He came to my wife and I about 2 weeks in after the surgery, and he said to us, he said, I need to meet you in that room right over there. And my wife lost it. She said, no, 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 not that room. He said, yes, yes, I need to meet you. No, no, I'm not going in that room. Take me to any other room in this hospital. Don't take me to that room. You can't give up on her. Don't take me to the room. Finally said, okay, all right, we'll go to some other room. He took us into a conference room of doctors and sat down there, and he said, we've done everything we can. We have done everything we can. There is nothing we can do. She's not going to make it through this. My wife pleaded through tears, said, don't give up on her. We're not giving up. We're praying. We've got friends who are praying. We're not giving up. Please don't give up on her. He said, I'm sorry, there's nothing else we can do. She went about another week struggling, hanging on between heaven and earth. And Dr. Ben Shikar came about a week later to us. And he said, I really need to meet you in this room over here. I grabbed my arm of my wife, and I thought, it's going to be hard. She never made a sound. She said, okay. One of the members of our church had made buttons with Hannah's face on it. And was giving them to everybody throughout the hospital, people we knew, people we didn't know, doctors and so forth. And my wife had grabbed one of those buttons. We sat down on that love seat. Dr. Benjikar sat down in the chair by himself, and my wife gave him that button, like this would encourage him to keep going on. I've never seen this before. I've been through a lot of different things for my own family or for others. I've never seen a doctor moved with tears so strongly as he was. I mean, the tears just dropped down onto that button as he just sat there and held that button in his hands and just wet the button with his tears. He said, we've done everything. We even called Boston Children's Hospital and consulted with them. They do this surgery more than anybody in the world does, and we've done everything right. There is nothing we can do. He apologized and apologized and apologized. And finally, he left. We had no plans of this. We didn't say anything to each other. When he walked out of the room and closed the door, my wife and I turned around on that love seat and got on our knees. She prayed first, and I closed in prayer. And we rededicate our life to God. We said, Lord, we believe you can do it even in this hour. But if you don't do it, we're going to keep serving you. I'm going to tell you why we're here. This is why. You don't do that because you think, oh, everything's going to work out. You know, be happy. Think happy thoughts. No, that's not how you do that. Not when you're there, you don't do that. You better take this right here. And you better believe the best is yet to come. God's talking to you today. You don't need to be discouraged any longer, not another moment. You don't need to talk about suicide. You don't need to be depressed. You don't need to be despondent of life. If you're a child of God, friend, you've got the promise of the book. There awaits for the people of God a rest. That rest is about to come.
Thank you for listening to the Parkside Baptist Church podcast. For more information about our church, you can visit us online at pbcmesquite.org. Or if you're ever in the Dallas, Texas area, we'd love to have you come visit our church.